our mental health, our struggles have had to come into the workplace because there's no escape. And what I want to do is to continue to think about how do we make this manageable, even when the world goes back to whatever normal is going to be.
Welcome to the Sonship Podcast. I'm your host, Danny Atias. You'll be hearing inspiring stories from people with purpose. And today's person with purpose is Debbie Forster, MBE, who is an award-winning figure in the areas of diversity, technology, innovation, and education. She is a portfolio consultant, coach, and the co-founder and CEO for the Tech Talent Charter, an industry collective which aims to deliver greater inclusion and diversity in the UK tech workforce. In 2016, Debbie was named Woman of the Year by Women in Science and Engineering. In 2017, she was awarded an MBE for services to digital technology and technology development. In 2018, Women in IT named her Diversity Leader of the Year. I think that was the same year that Avril Chester from episode one was named Entrepreneur of the Year. And I remember because I was there in the audience that day. In 2019, Computer Weekly named her Most Influential Woman in UK IT. And most recently, We Are Tech Women awarded Debbie their Editor's Choice Award for 2020. Debbie is a trustee for the British Council, serves on the Institute of Coding's Diversity Board, and serves on the Government's Digital Economy Council and its Money and Pension Service Advisory Board. Debbie, you certainly have your hands full. Welcome to the Sonship Podcast.
Thanks so much.
We start each episode of this podcast by asking our guest about their experience of Sonder. So as a reminder, Sonder is that realization that every passerby has a life as rich and conflicted as your own. It's that moment when your eyes are open to the fact that everyone is on their own journey and that sometimes those journeys become part of yours. Sometimes they happen in the background, and most often they're just thoughts, feelings, and experiences that you'll never know about. So Debbie, can you share your earliest or most memorable Sonder moment?
Thanks, Danny. I can think of three big Sonder moments for me, but I think what's most relevant in this point was a few years ago, I'm used to speaking at lots of events. I put on my game face, my go and stand on a stage and talk diversity, talk inclusion, talk innovation. But I was asked to speak at a women's event. And in that past year, I'd had a serious foot injury, surgery. I had been in a series of wheelchairs, crutches, and a knee scooter, which I highly recommend for mobility, but not a lot for dignity. And I remember getting in the crutches, going up to talk in front of this group, and everyone else who had spoken had something to share, but it was shiny and it was bright and it was innovative. And through sheer exhaustion, I remember talking with real vulnerability and really talking about that as much as I admire Sheryl Sandberg and leaning in, that sometimes I needed to lean back or I needed to lean on someone else. And what I said in exhaustion and in the back of my head, I probably was also thinking, well, this will make sure I don't ever have to talk at one of these events again. So what felt like an act of self-sabotage meant the number of women who came up and talked to me and who really opened up and showed me how alone I was not on that journey, that for how many of us, having tried to be a woman in a field and be that strong woman and do those things, but we aren't feeling that way. Someone said once, we judge our insides by other people's outsides. And that Sonder moment for me was, the more I am willing to bring that vulnerability when I speak to my business world, to bring the real me to the business me's world, the more I'm willing to say those things and to share the bits that feel messy, that feel scary, the more I feel connected to everyone else. It was one of those moments that, whether it's on a stage, in a Zoom call, in a conversation with people, I do try to, wherever I can, find those moments to give an honest answer to how are you doing, and then hold space with someone so they can do the same thing as well. And I've not yet had a time where I think, oh God, won't do that again. That was a bad move. We do that not just because we want an audience, but it is to create that trust of I'm going to bring my whole self to this meeting, this conversation, this event, so that you can too. And that has become a rich and energizing part of my life since then.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that, Debbie. I couldn't agree more. There are too many Instagram type filters on society and on our lives at the moment. And actually, we need to see the real people inside, and then that can help us relate more to the real people inside us. Part of the principle of this podcast, and particularly this question that you've just answered, is to start the conversation with vulnerability, to start the conversation with openness. And hopefully that then can lead to greater sharing, a deeper insight into each guest's journey, rather than just saying, tell me about this amazing tech talent charter that you've built. These conversations are about the people behind those achievements. And it's, where did that come from? And how did you come to go about to create these things?
And Danny, I love that because, you know, I'm forever asked, I hate that question that comes up in interviews. Who do you most admire? Who inspires you? Because it feels, you know, if you've got any imposter syndrome going on, it becomes a challenge. Am I going to pick someone who's inspiring enough to be inspiring? What do we mean by inspire? And inspire is someone or something that calls us to action, gives us that energy, that feeling that we could do more. And look, Michelle Obama, huge girl fan, and think she's amazing. But I wouldn't describe her purely as someone who inspires me, because I look at the Michelle Obamas of the world and think, crap, I could never do that. What inspires me are the women I know, the stories I know. So I get as much inspiration, and by inspiration, I mean, get off my backside and do something, from listening to what my daughter does, or someone in a coffee meeting. Because do I see myself ever becoming the first lady for the United States of America? Not really on the next 5-year plan. So platforms like this, conversations like this, I really think is vital. And I hate how much the world has broken over the last 18 months. But amidst the awfulness, I do love how many organizations, how many people, how many teams, we've gone from bring your whole self to work to actually work has to come into your lives. And so our mental health, our struggles have had to come into the workplace because there's no escape. And what I want to do is to continue to think about how do we make this manageable, even when the world goes back to whatever normal is going to be.
You talked about, you look at the Michelle Obamas and you think, well, I could never be that. Some of the guests that we've already had on this podcast, that person that they look at and they go, I could never be that, is themselves. Sometimes on the same day. This is Avril Chester winning this award, when a day earlier she was going through boxes of tissues, just thinking, I'm not that person. I can't be that person. But everyone around is looking at her and saying, you're that person that I aspire to be.
Someone said to me once, what do you do about your imposter syndrome? I was like, oh, baby, I tango with mine every day. And it is that love-hate relationship with that imposter syndrome. The more I do in coaching, the more I look into this bit of imposter syndrome, I'm getting more and more theories about it. I think we need to get a different relationship with what we call our imposter syndrome, because I think it's just a malfunctioning survival instinct that got bruised or beaten somewhere in the past. And it thinks it's some part of us that thinks it's protecting us. And we need to do that tango, get really close, really trying to understand it instead of just beating it down or trying to lock it in a closet, because it always comes out. It changes clothes. It puts a different hat on and comes back and starts gibbering away in your ear.
A good friend of mine, Dr. Mark Reed, is doing a lot of research into the imposter phenomenon, is what he calls it. And in fact, there are opportunities to get involved in part of his research, really light touch involvement in part of his research. Well, so I'm going to put some notes with this podcast so people can follow it if they want to. Debbie, you've created the Tech Talent Charter. I've personally been involved in being a signatory to that Tech Talent Charter about improving diversity and inclusion in tech. Really important. Take us back to the beginning. Where does your journey start?
Well, usually the accent is one of the first things whenever I do a talk somewhere, I have to explain. My American family think I sound kind of British, and the British think I sound a little bit Canadian, and the Canadians shake their heads, just walk away. I grew up all over the Southwest in tiny towns in Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. That is an important part of the journey. So very much moving around a lot when I was little. and so used to being the newcomer, having to figure out how to fit into a place. Had a wonderful teacher in high school that gave me a glimpse that there was a world out there I might want to travel to. I think what's also important is I grew up in a family with a mother who very much loved us, but now looking back, had real mental health issues. So I had a complicated childhood. I think anytime we go through something really tough, if we can get through it and we can work our way through it, it leaves us with both a superpower and some kryptonite. And so growing up in that childhood, it very much motivated me to be good at school, to be good at things. But in order to survive with my mother feeling I should look after my sister and brother, et cetera, I wanted to help people. And I got very good at reading people. But there was that start of, I want to make a difference in the world. Those give you lots of superpowers, great motivations. The kryptonite is, I sometimes feel it is my responsibility to fix all the problems in the world. And that I now know, the older I get, is a weakening aspect of, I need to play my part in the world, but I also need to look after myself. I need to learn to do those things. But where that led me initially from a small town in the middle of nowhere in the southwest of the US was I got into education. Because if you want to make change, education is a wonderful way of doing that. And I went to university in Texas. I became an English teacher. There was a scholarship to go and work on my master's up at Leeds. I went for it. I got it. So then I found myself in 1989 at Leeds University working on a degree. And that was one of the first times they began screaming for teachers around London. I told my dad, you need to help me sell my stuff, because I'm going to stay here forever. I told my mom I was going to be here for a year. Took a job in London at a boys' grammar school in outer London, because it was as different a background as I'd ever been. And I then spent the next 20 years in education. I was an English teacher to start with, but then you got to remember it was the 90s. I used a computer. And if you were in education in the 90s and used a computer, you quickly became tech. But for me, this was part of my wanting to change things. I love working with kids. I love education. And I love the doors it opens for young people. And what I saw back in the 90s was, one, if you started using tech, kids looked at education in a different way. But then even more importantly, as I started working in more challenging schools, tech was a way that any of my kids could get into jobs and careers they could never think of. After working in quite a challenging school for 6 years as a head, I was one of the youngest heads at the time, blah, 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 blah. I was doing a lot with computer clubs for girls. And so the organization that set that up, eSkills UK, was asking me to get more and more involved, hosting ministers, et cetera. I like going into something that's a big problem or something that scares me. And after 3 years, I've kind of figured it out. If I can't find a new way of challenging myself by 5 years, that itch becomes a rash and I do something rash and need to move on. So sort of at 5 years, I was looking at, do I want to stay a head teacher? They pitched me, said, come head up our policy area of tech and education. So this was a chance to work with the big boys. They were often boys, IBM, BT, Microsoft, on how we help get young people into education. At the time, there was an entrepreneur out there starting something called Apps for Good. As soon as I saw it, I loved it. It was a startup, not for profit, looking at getting young people, teaching them entrepreneurialism, innovation. I was starting to get an itch. Someone said, give her a call. I said, I think what you're doing is amazing. I think this would go down really well in schools. She called me. I quit my job. I sat down with her and had a, oh God, you've only done this in 2 schools. I got us into 100 schools. Roll forward 3 to 5 years. We have pilots in Spain and Portugal in the US, tens of thousands of kids doing it. 50% of whom were girls. And for the tech experts who volunteered, 40% were women. You know tech. You never use the word 50% or 40% in women and tech in the same sentence. That's how I started getting pulled into the conversations around diversity in tech. Sinead Bunting wrote the charter. She gathered a few of us. I said, if I have to go to another roundtable event on why there's no women in tech and talking about the problem, my head's going to explode. Let's do something different. We started that on top of everyone's day job. 2017, I was stepping back from Apps for Good, going to start my portfolio work. I said to the group, look, I'll do it front of my desk. Let's see what happens with Tech Talent Charter. That was January of 17. We had 17 companies. By Christmas, we were 100 companies. As of 2021, we're in 675 organizations. So it's sort of grown from there.
So you start off with this wanting to help other people, almost feeling obligated to help other people. And you've got to the point now where you've got to moderate yourself and you can't be there for everyone all the time. Otherwise, who's there for you? And then you've just got this journey, which is quite linear in terms of its education and then education with technology and then education, technology and diversity. And you're kind of building layer upon layer upon layer to get to this natural conclusion where you are really looking out for greater diversity in the room, greater inclusion through this tech talent charter.
Danny, I think it's something really important. When I've talked to a lot of people, you know, you've described it as linear. And I remember speaking at a panel event once where they said, it looks very strategic what you did. And I said, well, that's good. Because the way I describe it at the time, you remember dot to dot puzzles? There's that bit where it's still this mystery. You know, you get older and you can just look at it and you feel quite clever because you can already see the picture and how the numbers fit together. But when you're first learning it, it is very much you have your Crayola crayon and you're going, here's one, now find two, look around. You think you're going towards three. No, but that's how it felt at the time. Each, and I think it's where I try and reassure people, we still talk to people of what would you like to be when you grow up? What's your career? Where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? God knows. I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to be when I grow up. And I'm now really comfortable with that squiggly career of just not pressuring myself. Ultimately, where am I going to go? But to understand that it's a chapter by chapter and take the next step. Because again, if you're farther back the line, this looks very linear. But at the time, people were saying to me, you're crazy. You're a head teacher. You got a teacher's pension. And then you got a safe job working with government and everything else. Why in heaven's name are you going to go and work with startup? But it's knowing in yourself at that stage. Sometimes it's desperation. I can't not do this. Or this just feels like something I have to do. It's only afterwards when we look back that it feels strategic or linear. At the time, it feels a bit messy, but I really wanted to move from one to the next.
You were also charting new waters. Whilst it's a linear path, it doesn't mean it was predetermined or predestined. Yeah. And you're starting as a teacher in 1989. You're certainly not going to be saying, well, by 2021, this is exactly what I want to do. It didn't even exist. And that it's something that we've talked about in previous podcasts. When we say, what do you want to be when you grow up? The answer to that is, I don't know. Yeah. Because you don't know, because those roles don't even exist yet.
Exactly.
To try and think that you need to fit into this pre-industrial mold where you're going to go in and you're going to work in a factory and going to be a specialist in X, Y, Z, it just doesn't fit anymore. We've got to get those young people's parents more comfortable with that uncertainty.
There was some interesting research done years ago, and they were talking about resilience, that ability of we make a mistake, we fall down, we hurt ourselves, we get ourselves up and we go again. And they'd done some research with groups of young people. Do you know who came up worst in terms of resilience? Bright girls. And it was a really interesting piece of research. And I think there's sometimes for women, we're terrified of mistakes. We're terrified of getting wrong. And we've come up through an exam system that rewards perfection and getting it right. Whereas we know in life, success is just finally getting there and what you do when things burst into flame and when it goes wrong and when you make that mistake. But we're so afraid. And quite often when I'm doing some of my coaching and mentoring, so often what I'm doing with women is helping them let go of that fear of getting it wrong. Or what they will think and trying to understand who is they to you and what does this mean? It's the, of course, we're going to get it wrong. And then what do you do? We need to start seeing failure and mistakes as waypoints, not endpoints on the journey. But we're not doing that with young people and we're not doing that with ourselves. And I think for women in particular, we teach ourselves to be risk averse. Mistake averse. And, you know, and I worked in a girls' grammar school and I could watch a girl when you ask a question, watching how good they were at hiding until they had the right answer. It was that they will do anything not to get it wrong. And our exam system really reinforces that. And then business does that. So I think for everyone, because men have a different kind of price tag in that fear of, and in the way we value success and how men have to go at it. So the system is killing us all.
We have
to rethink that. We have to redefine those things.
We know barriers to entry, even into jobs and careers in terms of the roles that women will apply for as opposed to the roles that men will apply for. There are a lot of things that can be done for the employer to think about how they position it and how they interview and how they have a conversation, but also for women in terms of that coaching and mentoring and getting them to see things from a different perspective. And once they've experienced it the right way, it's just so hard. We go back to vulnerability. And by definition, you are afraid to be vulnerable because you don't know how that's going to be used against you. You don't know how that's going to be used to push you down. And we've already covered a few episodes where we talk about ethnicity and we've covered gender. And it's just a repeating story. Society needs to kind of wake up to this. And this is the kind of thing Tech Talent Charter is doing. It's trying to help educate and it's trying to help raise the bar. I remember when I discovered Tech Talent Charter, I was just trying to get my head around what it was. What is it? What's it trying to do? What does signing up to it actually mean? And really, all of those questions are really difficult to answer until you understand that there is a problem. You talk about going to these round table when it's kind of full of men. And so I've been going to them most of my professional career. And I don't necessarily see the gap because I'm part of the problem, but not part of the gap. And it's then once you start to see the gap, you see how you can become part of the solution.
Yeah.
And using your allyship or your privilege or your position yeah. to be able to really shift the tables, and then how much richer and how much better things become when you haven't got a group of people who look the same, sound the same, think the same, have had the same education, making the same decisions, and things aren't changing.
But I think it's also, we've been moving the dial on, because when we first started, the buzzword was diversity, diversity, diversity. And that's fine, because you're right. We've got to get other kinds of people in the room. But if all you do that and you've not changed the culture, the ways of doing things, that safety and growth, then you're either going to have people bounce right out of there, or in order to survive, they're going to try and find a way of becoming just like everyone else in the room. You know, the recruitment is part of it, but we're more and more talking to companies to think about the inclusion, the belonging, the equality of opportunity for people, because we can't just get them in the room. We have to create the safety, the structures, the belief that they have voices and voices that are heard and changed, that we grow them into leadership, because that's when the change happens. Because otherwise, we're just then saying, come in, square peg. Now we're just going to need to carve you a bit. If it is just a group of women in the room trying to solve the problem, usually the solution is going to be the women should change themselves. Or in fact, if we get everyone in the room, it's how do we create a solution? Because the more you start unpacking some of these things, it's actually only work. It's not even working for all men. It's working for a certain kind of man in a certain kind of mindset. It is, we have to change the culture in these things. When you were talking about the coaching and mentoring, it is helping people from underrepresented groups begin to see themselves differently, to begin to reframe how they see things like threat and vulnerability and those sorts of things. For me, when I was much younger, I had to accept that ultimately, as far as I could see for a really long time, I was always going to be scared. But what I learned that was liberating for me is bravery, and having courage and bravery is not being scared. It is the walking while you're scared. And so for me, from my 20s onwards, what's helped drive my career and drive my growth has been, I'm happiest when I'm doing something that faintly terrifies me. What's happened, I think, more in the last 3 to 5 years is we also need to create a sense in growth of sustainability, helping empower us to say no, helping us know when to push back, when to create boundaries. And in the last year and a half, I'd love to pretend that everything I did in my coaching, my mentoring, my board memberships, and my running the Tech Talent Charter, I was doing this from my Zen peak of serenity. But I worked myself to a stage where I realized I was burnt out. And I mean, badly burned out, where I needed to seek professional care to do this. And there is that bit again. We need to help grow people to know when we need to lean in, to know when we can say yes, to take risks. But we also need to know when we can lean back and say no, or not yet, or not right now, or I don't want to do that. So, you know, I've had to, and this is where I've said my journey's been. Initially, it was that leaning into the fear, and I can do things and I want to help people. what the rest of my life is learning the balance in that of, it is not my responsibility to do that for people, that I can look after myself. I can say no. I thought I had a whole lot of that figured out before lockdown. And then I've had to go back to school, as it were, and relearn some lessons at a much deeper level, because I went into this while telling everybody and working with the people that I coach and mentor, treat this like a marathon, not a sprint, look after yourself. And I just didn't. And when I would know that I'm getting burnout, I had a professional saying to me, you need to cut back. And I just kept saying, I can't. And it was because I couldn't find a way to give myself permission.
It's almost like, do what I say, not what I do. And sometimes we need our own advice played back to us.
Yes.
Because we can see the problems, we know what to do and what not to do, but we don't do it ourselves. And I don't think that's because we think we're above it. It's just because maybe we overestimate our resilience. And I can relate to a lot of what you just said. I won't take on an opportunity unless it absolutely terrifies me. If it doesn't terrify me, it's just not worth the effort. And it doesn't mean that I then want to be terrified for every single moment. It's not. It's saying, now, how do I manage through that? How do I sustainably take on this challenge? But it needs to be a challenge. And why is that? I suppose if it doesn't terrify you, then anyone can do it. It doesn't need me to do it. Maybe that's the approach. I'm trying to unpack it myself.
I think what has then happened, I have got very good at that. But it is also realizing, I somehow in my head, if an opportunity presented itself, if someone asked me to do something, if it scared me, if I could do it and I'd been asked, then I should do it, shouldn't I? There was no sense of, you have too much on your plate. Don't be stupid. Don't take that now. I probably earlier in my life, what I needed to do was to lean in and realize I could take those challenges. Now, as I've got very good at those, it is also then saying, I need to be as good at saying to people, no, I can't do that. Or that is a super opportunity. Let me introduce you to someone else. Let me connect you with someone else because I have too much on. And I think that's part of the vulnerability as well. Because I do think I've felt this for a while and it's become even more true. I think in the last 10 years or so, we have fetishized not just entrepreneurship, but that hustle culture, that bit when you ask, how are you guys doing? If you aren't saying, I am stressed out and I am exhausted, then you're clearly not in the game. And we have now got where, in some kind of perverse way, we wear stress and exhaustion like a badge of honor. And that was before COVID. A lot of times I was trying to get people to just, when I'm doing my coaching, let's unpack, what do you mean by stressed? What are those things? If we unpack stressed, we start getting some real emotions. I am overwhelmed. I'm angry. I'm scared. And then we can start doing something about it. I thought I had it figured out. But then again, COVID, lockdown. And then almost your sonus moments were bad for me because I was seeing firsthand through my coaching and tech talent chart so many things and so many scary, bad things for other people. I was struggling to look after myself because I could tell myself, but look, when I'm working with the people that I'm coaching, they're going through so many things. They're working with those people. Look at the people I know who are having bereavements and all those sorts of things. And it was my daughter, when I was saying to her ripe wisdom of 25, was saying, Mom, you've got to cut back. You've got to start turning stuff off. You're doing too much. And I was like, you don't understand. There's this and they're happening. How can I? And she said, Mom, you can drown in 6 inches water as much as 6 feet. Don't minimize what's going on for you. You have to get yourself safe before you can do something for anyone else. We've come through a global crisis and all the rules were off. Some people have been through some incredible traumas, but even if we've not been personally traumatized, we're in a world that is traumatized. I think issues of self-care, empathy, compassion with others, compassion with ourselves, we're having to revisit in a very, very different way. Woe betide the person that is thinking that we go back to the old rules. I was talking to a friend who's in a large organization I will not name. She's sweating if she'd hear this. But she was on some call where everybody was asked to share one or two words that described how they were. And she said it was the most terrifying word cloud coming up because it was exhausted, burnt out, tired. We need to remember there are two groups of people coming out of this. There are people who've been traumatized because they have been out of work or in precarious work. Then there's also a group of people who, on the one hand, feel very grateful because we have been in work, but who are on their knees, exhausted mentally, emotionally. We need to take note of that as leaders and managers and peoples in the space to help get people better.
Your daughter's advice really was that information you get when you get on a plane, which is you got to put your oxygen mask on first before you can help other people, because you won't be able to help the other people if you're not able to look after yourself. It's really sound advice. When you talk about wearing that stress as a badge of honor, something I found myself stopping to say since COVID started, the people go, "Oh, you're too busy. You're taking too much on. You're trying to do too much. When do you rest?" And I'd always say, "I sleep when I'm dead." I don't say that anymore because it's just a stupid thing to say, isn't it? And it's saying that you'll be dead sooner if you don't do something about it.
Yeah.
And just looking after yourself, and you can do things so much better with so much more awareness and involvement and compassion. Recently, we've had the Olympics, and we've seen now real life examples of people saying, "I've got to stop. I cannot do this." I don't know how the general public react to that. I think you'll get some, certainly in the circles that we're in the information funnels that we appear in on social media or LinkedIn, which will be very supportive. But I suspect generally people will find it difficult to relate to that, because they're not relating to the individual. They're relating to the thing, the person on stage, the person on the screen, not the real person behind that. I suppose we've come to regard those people as superheroes. And so we don't think they're human. We don't think they're vulnerable. So Debbie, let's go back a little. We've heard a lot about your journey, and we've heard a lot about the problems and challenges of society. I want to hear more about you, the kind of the Debbie behind the helping of other people. You mentioned at the beginning, three Sunder moments came to mind. Would you like to share another one of those?
I think the earliest one was obviously very profound. So that was back when I was 20. I had grown up in this tricky childhood. But when I say tricky childhood, I think what you need to realize is, from the outside looking in, I was from a super fantastic, very Christian home. Okay. So we could have a scary old episode happening in the background with my mom, and not to judge her, real mental health issues. But the doorbell would go, we'd be cleaning out, sorting out. She would answer the door, and then we would hear from people, "Oh my God, your mother is just so godly and so wonderful. You should be so grateful." So I had that disjoint growing up. And again, growing up, you don't know. That's not like everybody's house, you know, what everybody does. Everybody's mom swings around by your hair, does these things, screams these sorts of things. If you're in a dysfunctional home, the dysfunction is held in a very delicate balance. And when I left for university, that was bringing out one little piece of the puzzle, and it got much wonkier for a while. And as that got even crazier, I developed an eating disorder, which sounds terrible, and it was, but it meant I got help. When I got help, I then realized, oh, this isn't actually a normal childhood. This isn't what happens. The moment of connection for me, I came out of that grateful, healthier, but feeling broken. Because remember, this was the 80s. We didn't even have a language for mental health. Okay. It was just nothing. But I remember coming back to university, and one or two people from university knew, because I was sort of leading some things at university, what had happened to me. And they said, "Are you willing to talk about it?" I remember talking at an event to new freshmen coming in about having the eating disorder, seeking help. And that moment for me again was, okay, I am willing to do this because I want to make a difference, but this makes me the freak on campus. But what came out of that was that moment of connection of all sorts of people coming up and saying, "Oh, well, I have this and I do that." And it was that connection. First was understanding that my childhood was more broken than I'd understood, but then understanding I can overcome that. And if I can be brave enough to share it, that doesn't shut doors for me. That opens other doors. So that put me on a path of the beginnings of vulnerability before we had a word for it. And I just thought I was just kind of crazy, but it worked for me. And that's what I did. The other thing was looking at under COVID, you mentioned part of my portfolio is that I do the coaching and mentoring. And the coaching for me is one of the most awesome things I get to do. It is a weird thing to realize that I can make some money doing this. I work with social entrepreneurs, but it is that privilege of being with people on the journey. For me, the last 18 months, that connection was COVID has stripped back everything. And that in the first instance, the people that I get to coach are just such a diverse group of people doing amazing social enterprises and organizations across the UK and just such different backgrounds. And it is that heartbreaking connection of seeing lives prior to this, it was great, but I got to work with him very much as the social entrepreneur. Yeah. COVID was that connection of, okay, I'm going to be with you on this journey, the whole of your human self. If it means you've lost somebody, if it means you're struggling with the challenges of living by yourself now in a flat for a year, of watching what's happening to your charity, working with the homeless and all of those sorts of things. That connection of realizing has been that calibration again for me. I was so busy watching and engaging with that piece that's humbling and painful. Watching those breakthroughs are the greatest gift, the greatest privilege you can have. But my moment has had to be, I need to remember I'm in that journey too. And bringing that humility. And we were saying, you know, Danny, you and I might have had this podcast a few weeks ago and we had to reschedule it. Well, depending on your listener's idea, that is either a really good or a really bad thing that we didn't then, because I was still going to do it because I still hadn't admitted to myself how burnt out I was. We all use that phrase in the same way that we've done that. I am stressed. I am exhausted. I'm crazy. I was really from Christmas onwards getting worse and worse, but not really seeing it because I was getting disjoint. I was so connected with everyone else's journeys. I was getting disconnected from my own journey. And even when my other half who lives with me would say things, I would do the, yeah, shh. I'm fine. Stuff's happening. It was suddenly then experiencing really what burnout is. And that it's aptly named, feeling as if all of my nerve endings were burnt. I could do the smiley face on camera, come off and just think, I don't care. I could have an amazing session on a coaching session, come off, hear something and go to pieces. And just this growing disconnect of, oh God, this isn't me. I think the flip side of the concept you're talking about is we need to remember our place in that journey. I'll let myself get lost in helping support, curate, grow other people's journeys because I want to disconnect from mine. I do have that old message from childhood of you're never quite enough. And so that bit of going to a professional and having this woman saying to me, you know what this is, you know what you should be doing. Why can't you give yourself permission? She was saying to me, Debbie, you should be taking 6 weeks off work. And I sort of did this maniacal laugh and I said, it can't happen. And she said, no, seriously, I can write a medical note for your boss to give you 6 weeks off. To which I did another maniacal laugh. I said, I work for myself. I know her. She's a bitch. She'll never let you off. She'll never let this happen. I'm having to redefine and look at how do I look after myself? How do I do those things? But again, I have a larger group of women that I thought, again, I've got to be willing to be vulnerable. Several had been asking me, we're not hearing as much what we're doing. And I went in and just sort of said, here's where I am. This is what it is. Apparently, I am moving from what is called chronic into acute burnout. I'm going to be pulling back for a while. Watching the people coming in then to say, I had this 3 years ago. You need to do these things. I'm here for you if you need it. Somebody else saying, this is happening to me right now. And that's been that moment for me recently that I just keep having to go back to. And it means stepping back from some things or resigning from things or saying, no, thank you very much. Or no, I'm not going to do that. And it is painful. It is uncomfortable. It's training muscles I haven't used in a long time to do that, drawing the boundaries, which is the other half of vulnerability. I do a lot of reading of Brené Brown, and vulnerability is bringing your whole self to it, but it's also looking after yourself. It's creating those boundaries.
All of your experiences are saying, when you open yourself up, instead of people pulling away, they lean in and you start to see that everyone is going through these kind of problems. And more than that, they're offering to help. So you're constantly trying to help all these people around you by making yourself vulnerable, that two-way experience where you can help each other. So when are you taking those 6 weeks off?
Well, what I'm doing, I'm making a great escape. So we've been working sort of through the summer and then we're going to go off to Spain. We've proved in the last 18 months that we can work from abroad. So we're going to take the odd week here and there, but I am going to be working from Spain. I'm not getting on a plane. I'm not getting in a little box of germs. We're going to drive across. I got to the point because I do worry what's going to happen. And I had to look at my other half, and this was me looking after myself. I don't care what it takes to get me across. I will be a boat person heading the wrong direction. We are going somewhere because I need to unplug, turn off, get away from screens and see something else outside the window.
Are you going to take a digital detox.
Yes, I am going to do more periods of digital detox because, again, it's galling. My 20-something daughter is the one that tells me, you're way too online, mom. You need to unplug. You need to do these sorts of things. And it is a detox because it is glued to our hands and our eyeballs mm-hmm. go and we're scrolling through all sorts of things to no good reason.
I've been there in the past where I've said, right, I'm going to switch off the notifications. That didn't work. I'm going to move the app to another screen. No, that didn't work. I'm going to uninstall the app. And that didn't work. I'm going to pull the SIM card out of this device and just go. And actually, it was a couple of years ago, but it was a week or 2 weeks completely offline. And it is, wow. It's so, so refreshing having maybe a year ago come off all the social networks apart from LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn far too much. I'm probably spending the same amount of time on social networks. It's just on one. And it's just going, well, you can just leave it and check it once a day. We're fighting big tech money, influencing psychology, which is trying to get us to engage with their platforms more. That's really hard to do. So,
and it's really galling when you realize it. It is a Pavlovian response. It is that feeling of, oh my God, they have absolutely wired this into my brain. Oh, somebody hit a like, somebody tagged me, ring the bell and slobber like the dog. So Mr. Zuckerberg is now talking about his next big dream is the metaverse, which is bringing everything together and virtual. If you've read Ready Player One, great sort of light dystopian piece. Mark wants to build that. If there's going to be a metaverse, I don't want Mr. Zed building that. It goes back to my day job. I need the right people around the right tables. Yeah. I am not a let out. I love tech when it works well. We just need to make sure there's more people at the table who are designing this. Otherwise, we are building and working towards a kind of dystopian novel we would never have read. We need more people in the room to say no, not just no, but hell's no.
Totally agree. Debbie, thank you so much for giving up your precious time to share your story. How can people find out more about the Tech Talent Charter, follow you, and get in touch if they need to?
So to find out about the Tech Talent Charter, check out our website, techtalentcharter.co.uk. You can find us on Twitter and on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter at Debbie Forster. I'm on LinkedIn. And for companies to join, for people to get involved with the Tech Talent Charter, it is free. And this is about getting in the room with all the other companies that actually want to make this happen. And the more people in the room, the more we can actually really shake things up.
I really appreciate your time, Debbie, and you being so vulnerable and sharing your story.
Danny, thank you for setting this up. This is a wonderful platform, and it's lovely to have a space where these conversations are happening.
And does yours have a name? Have you named your imposter syndrome?
In the last month, I've realized it's probably called mom. So I have to tell myself at the moment on a daily rate when those messages come up, go, mom was wrong. Mom is wrong. Mom's wrong. No, nope, that's not what it is. That's not truth. Keep moving. Keep dancing. It's going to be all right.
I think we're out of time for this therapy session, Debbie.